This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Thorin Mooney is a name you probably know. She's a witch, a YouTuber, a Wiccan high priestess, a blogger. She's pretty active on social media. She's an author and a name that a lot of people respect, myself included. Her latest book, The Witch's Path, Advancing Your Craft at Every Level, is something that I think has been missing for a long time. When you pick it up, you might be initially confused because you might be expecting a book that's all about highly advanced magic and really complicated spells and the names of forgotten gods or something like that. But what you find inside of the pages is something different and very, very special. Thorin opens the book talking about knowing that it's a full moon outside and also knowing you're not going to do anything about it, which is a sentiment that a lot of us that have been on this path for decades can, you know, sympathize with. It's a book that tells you that you're not alone if you're someone who's thinking that, you know, maybe you've gotten off of the broomstick and you're not quite sure how to get back on, or you're looking around social media and thinking that everybody's a better witch than you are. A more dedicated witch, a more powerful witch, a more knowledgeable witch, a much more active witch. Thorin's book, The Witch's Path, tells you that it's okay to be human, because even she, a world-famous Wiccan high priestess, author of multiple books of witchcraft, sometimes just sits the moon out. I thought it would be really fun, and so did she, to have kind of a crossover interview. She was pretty keen on my upcoming book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, which, if you're listening to this on its release day, comes out next week, September 28th, 2021. Her book actually just came out earlier this month, September 8th, so we're 20 days apart. We thought it would be fun because she liked my book, I liked hers, and we each had questions for each other. So we sat down, got on a Zoom call, turned on the microphones, and just kind of dove in. I'll be honest, it's a really, really long conversation, but we cover a lot of ground. We talk about sort of the realities of publishing. We talk about what it's like to be afraid to put yourself out there. We talk about what it's like to write, to practice, and to be in this community as it's changed so much in the last decade. This conversation is presented as though you were sitting down with two friends. You're going to catch us right smack in the middle of talking to one another, just like we do privately all the time. So it's a bit unorthodox, but enjoy.
And hello, everybody. This is Thorin Mooney from Publishing Land, here to tell you that none of it is organic, everybody. All of it is part of marketing. We know what we're doing. Some of us better than others. I don't know what I'm doing, but like, nobody's accidentally famous on things when they write books, everybody.
No.
Like, follower counts are cultivated, and they're cultivated in very specific, documented ways. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing the number of doors that start just magically opening for you once that, like, not that you have a certain number of followers, but that they see that you're trending up. Like that suddenly you're showing up now on people's For You page or on the Instagram, like you're showing up on, what is that? That page where
the
you really
search
kinda,
page or whatever.
Yeah. That
not For You, but it is.
Yeah. It's the Instagram version of the For You page, like that search page or whatever. Like when like people that, you know, give people careers, they know when you start showing up on things.
Yep.
As I've started showing up on things in the last year, it's incredible the number of, hey, we were just noticing, you have a severe lack of jewelry in your videos. Would you like some jewelry and like $100? I was like, no.
Well, no. Even like within probably our kind of realm, thinking about publishers, et cetera, the difference between how much help I'm getting to market The Witch's Path versus anything else I've ever written is leaps and bounds. And it's not because I'm a better writer now, everybody. Like, it's because I now have 12K followers, whereas I used to have 2K.
Yeah.
Like, that's just objectively the difference. And I think we kind of have, and I'm saying all of these things, everybody, like, not as a Llewellyn author, but as somebody who also has a job at a different publishing house. Uh-huh. Like, I work in publishing, and everybody like has this idea that, well, books become bestsellers because their content is amazing. And
no.
Like, everybody, like, and I'm thinking here about like Mariah Carey and Jessica Simpson and
I
all
was
these,
just
like, music.
Thinking,
you're thinking about that, right?
I'm like okay, people don't understand the writing thing because mm-hmm. not a lot of people just don't write. But everybody thinks they can sing in their car. Everybody thinks that they're a good singer in their car. And what I realized a billion years ago was, especially watching like, not X Factor, with The Voice, mm-hmm. you know, American Idol and stuff like that. There's a lot of Mariah Careys out there. And I'm not saying that to be facetious. I'm like, it's Mariah Carey is not a once in a lifetime talent. There's a lot of people around the world that apparently can sing like Mariah Carey. It's not better.
Mariah Carey is great. This isn't
Mariah
a knock
great.
On Mariah Carey.
But we have not the only one that can sing like that.
Right.
It's just
like
a lot of luck, a lot of who you knew, a lot of, and a lot of all of it. I mean, you know, yeah, there's getting discovered, but once you do that, I mean, what, like, how many winners of American Idol have there been, and how many Kelly Clarksons are there? You know, there's the luck of the opportunity, but then to stick around and to stay around and to get supported and stuff is like a whole other thing. There's a lot of calculation. There's a lot of hard work behind the scenes to make it look organic.
Yes. And a lot of that doesn't necessarily have to do with the person whose face is on the cover. I don't know, like, I think about how calculated some of these efforts are. And I feel like when I use words like that, it makes it sound like it's bad or like I'm opposed to these things. And I'm not. I just wish that people had an understanding of them so that they sort of knew, first of all, what they're buying, what they're supporting. But also, I think it should be encouraging. Like, you also have the Mariah Carey voice or whatever. Like, she had all of these various kinds of opportunities thanks to whatever. I mean, people ask me about, I'm sure they ask you too, like, how do I publish a witch book? How do I write a witch book? And on the one hand, all I did was go to Llewellyn's webpage, which has a submissions page mm-hmm. and tells you exactly what they need. This is what you should be in your proposal. And by the way, they want to know how big your platforms are, because that matters just as much, if not more, than what you're actually writing. Because they have copy editors and editors. Like, they can fix what you're writing, right? Autotune exists.
I was going to say, there's autotune.
Autotune exists.
Yeah.
Right?
Autotune exists.
It's much more about like what you already have in place and what they can sell. So I did all of those things. That's true. I wrote a proposal. They get a lot of proposals. The real reason, like, I get to write rich books is because, like, I had the resources to travel. I saved up and I went to PantheaCon. I made friends with other authors. I did a lot of these things very consciously, not because I'm like calculating like Ava Perone and the Madonna version, right? Like, it's, but because, like, I have a music background and I have a publishing background, and like, I know how things work.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You also can write a witch book, but if you think that you're going to be like a famous witch author, your book is going to be well received purely on the merits of its content, You are wrong.
You're wrong.
You are wrong.
You are wrong. The reason that you like the authors that you like is because it's that Devil Wears Prada moment.
It sure is. I was just thinking about that.
You like the authors that you like because a small number of people decided that those were going to be the people that you liked.
Well, and since we're part of kind of like a religious movement, a cultural movement, mm-hmm. like, isn't it just a coincidence that the way people identify as witches, the Green Witch, whatever, whatever, isn't it interesting that that always correlates to what's popular in publishing?
Yes, it's crazy.
Weird.
That's
it's
a book
crazy.
Title. Oh, you know, what I'm looking for a Green Witchcraft. There's a book title called that. Isn't that funny?
Right. Isn't that just a coincidence that the way the community, like what you think in your soul is your path, also correlates to the best-selling books on the market?
It's bizarre. It's
weird.
And it's I don't know, there's a more cynical part of me that looks and says, well, and then you look at people's platforms, people that also sell books and people that also sell classes and things like that, and how they also sort of transform themselves every few years to keep up with a trend. Mm-hmm. You know, it's...
And I don't think that that's nefarious. I'm not here to tell you that it's wrong, but I am here to say that those are things that we need to weigh. Like as discerning
that,
people making choices.
There is just a bit of discernment there on the part of the reader and the seeker, because this isn't as much as it, and you go, this is an author on author thing. So you go really well into it in your book, which is delightful, The Witch's Path.
Yours here.
Thank you. You know, and I think we both sort of talk about this, about how intertwined witchcraft and magical spirituality is intertwined with like wellness trends and exercise and live well and, you know, whatever the hell Gwyneth Paltrow's doing this weekend or whatever. Like it's just, it's very intertwined there. So it's easy to sort of get it confused with wellness and get it confused with sort of a mainstream thing. It's easy to get lost in the commodification of it.
Well, even so, I'm sitting here, I just received the new hardback of Penzex Inner Temple. And like, what's the category on the back? Mind, body, spirit. What does that mean, everybody?
I don't know, but
because it's about witchcraft.
Can I tell you that for a second Zoom cut out, and what I heard was Pet Sex Inner Temple, and that was a very different book than what I thought you were about to show me. So
that is the chapter that was added for the anniversary edition, everybody. You're welcome. Sorry, Christopher.
The Inner Temple.
Sorry
of Pet
for
Sex.
How I am.
So that's yes.
Oh no. But yeah, it's called Mind, Body, Spirit. And even like, I had this kind of like New Year's resolution to myself, where I was going to explore like new fitness routines. You know, the gym closed, right? So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? And I decided that one of the things I was going to try was yoga, which I hadn't tried before. And I was like, okay, like there's got to be like an ethical kind of engaging way to do this that actually like fuels, like maybe I can do the double whammy and I can like improve my flexibility and be healthier and more mindful of my body while also complementing what I'm up to kind of as an occultist. Like there's got to be a way to not be an asshole doing
those
things.
I mean, it's a spiritual practice.
Exactly. So I'm looking around for like YouTube channels and whatever, but I really need some structure. If I can get into classes or with a teacher, I will. And a lot of yoga studios took things online this year. So cool. I'm on board. And don't you know that every single studio I looked at in the North Carolina area, I'm in the Raleigh area, they all also offer full moon rituals and crystal cleansing, whatever, whatever. And like, you can go to class, but then you can also like watch as the instructor waves around a sage bundle and says something about the moon over some crystals, as though that is a health practice. How fascinating.
It is interesting. And that's one of the questions I think that both of us sort of challenge the reader on is there a version of spiritual, is there a version of magical witchcraft based spirituality that you can practice that removes classism, that removes the economy of it all, that removes the bastardization of multiple other practices and sincerely held religious beliefs of living religions around the world. Is there a version of that that exists, and can you practice it? And, you know, you're shaking your head. The answer to a lot of it is, I mean, there's no, because there's a lot of, you know, the answer to a lot of it is there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, right? I mean, there's no harmless consumption. But that's on the other hand, one can at least be a little bit more conscious of what they're doing and why they're doing it, and ask themselves whether or not it's worth continuing to do, I think.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely think that's true. This idea that, what do you do living in a capitalistic system? I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think the other part of it is even more foundational than that. Pierre Bourdieu and before him, others wrote about the concept of habitus, this idea that you are a conglomeration, that's not the word I want, an amalgamation of who you're born to, what region you're born in, how much money you had, where you went to school, like all of that stuff makes you who you are. You have a habitus, mm-hmm. right? And you don't just get to put that down. And so at some point I can only be conscious of so many things. Sure. Like I'm trapped in a body. I have a particular background. My language limits me. There's never going to be a moment where I am not this body of part.
It actually, I thought a lot about that in reading your chapter on devotion, which felt like a personal attack.
Did it really? Oh, good.
I was like, oh, this is the book. Oh, man. Oh, boy.
I feel like I'm going to make people mad with that chapter.
No, not at all. But I love the line. I highlighted it. You must locate the core of your craft and do the work that it requires. My dear friend Velma Nightshade always said, do the stuff. But I feel like this line just really takes it one step further and asks you to do some asking of why you're doing things and what is important about those things. There's some discernment inside of this statement that I loved. Well, you must locate the core of your craft. And obviously, you know, there's a lot more context around the sentiment of like consciously really examining your craft, the purpose of your craft, why you're here, what it is that you're doing, what it is that you're hoping to accomplish. And what is the core of that? That attempt to accomplish something and then do the work that that requires. And I just want to know, why are you attacking me in your book?
Because I really just don't like you. So that whole thing, I've really sat with this a lot in the last couple of years. In fact, I've got a Witch's Almanac article and a Llewellyn, I think it's the Witch's Companion or maybe it's the Magical Almanac, essays coming out with other publications where I really wrestled with this thing very specifically because it really bothers me very deeply. And that's the notion that witchcraft is work. And we tell people all the time, you've got to do the work, or that person has done the work, or you're not doing the work. And nobody ever tells you what the fucking work is. What does that mean? Like, if you actually sit down and talk to people, they will tell you very different things. Some people think, oh, well, witchcraft is work because stuff is actually hard. You have to read and that's hard. And sometimes you have to get up at midnight and you have to do inconvenient rituals and that stuff is all hard. That's why it's work. Mm-hmm. But if you talk to other people, when they say work, what they mean is like emotional labor, like therapy or like self-examination. Sure. And those are different kinds of work. But we throw that stuff around on the internet and we never tell people what it means or what we mean when we're using it. And then we get real mad when other people aren't doing the work. So I really wanted to wrestle with that. And kind of the conclusions that I reached are, oh, look, more Protestantism. Like, this is Max Weber, Protestant work ethic. Labor is holy. Like, fun is bad. One of the things I really appreciated about your book, you have this whole section where you talk about, like, let's talk about how witchcraft makes you look silly. And it's fun, right?
And have a very similar section. I was so glad to see that in there. It's this parallel. I loved that parallel thought.
Yes.
Like, embrace the fact that you are going to look silly while you do this.
You are literally waving a magic stick, sir.
Yes.
Right? Like,
you are wearing a funny outfit. You have weird stuff drawn on you or drawn on a piece of paper. You are chanting around a fire. You are dancing a funny dance and it is offbeat.
And you're getting mad when other people think it's funny.
Yes.
It's funny.
It's funny. Good God, laugh at it. It's okay.
I think one of the reasons why we get so offended at laughter is because, well, witchcraft is work. I'm laboring over here, everybody. And I'm not saying that witchcraft isn't work. It is, but I think we need to examine what that means. And if we really want to change the minds of people who are coming in, then we need to tell them explicitly what that work is or what we mean when we use the term. It's no different than, like, did you have that teacher at some point in your life who, like, it's like they wouldn't explain things in class and then they would give you D's or whatever, and they never, the whole semester or term was about figuring out what they want because they won't tell you. We all have a story about a teacher like that. And I feel like that's 99% of what happens in witchcraft communities.
Yeah.
It's like, we're so mad at young people. We're so mad at teenagers and TikTok and whatever, but they need to do the research. They need to do the work. Well, if you don't, and I'm saying this as a teacher, yeah, like a licensed teacher, if you don't tell students what the expectation is and what the outcome should look like, you're not going to get it.
Well, and also, you know, that's kind of been a, I don't know the, I wrote a book and it's coming out and I've become like anti-book somehow in the last several months. I'm like, okay, yeah, I wrote a book, but like y'all need to quit being so precious about the concept of it's written in a book. So it's therefore more important than something someone says on a YouTube video or something someone says here or there or the other way. Because I'm like, we revere the faux ancientness of this practice. We revere the concept of this handed down magical tutelage. But it was handed down with words, with verbal words and actions and teaching and in person, like just telling you how I do something and showing you how I do something. What is YouTube? What is TikTok, if not another way of passing on this sort of verbal lineage, you know? I mean, what is it if it's not just the next way of creating an oral tradition? Yeah, there is some bad information out there, but if you've read some books, there is some bad information in books too. Like, you know, that the defend occult books thing was going around, and it's a great thing. We should absolutely like support books and stuff, but like there's also this idea that just because it was in a book, it was like run by the Witches Council so that it's objectively factually accurate. And I'm like, well, that's not true.
That's true. You just weren't invited. No, totally. Well, and that was kind of one of the questions I had for you.
Yes.
Was okay, like you're a podcaster, you're a content creator on TikTok, my friend.
I hate that. I so hate
you are. So like given that you've operated in these other mediums, and this is something I wrestle with too, mm-hmm. What's the point of another book? And what did you have in mind in writing yours, given that like we all know that there's kind of a problem inherent to this idea that books are the ultimate authority?
Well, I think I wanted to play to it because we do in this community specifically have such a reverence for books. Other community, the fitness community, not so much a reverence for books. You know, we have a reverence for people that we, you know, if we want to see how to do a bench press, you want to watch someone do reading a book about a bench press, that at least in that community, they have gotten it in their heads that there's some stuff about certain kinds of practices, especially as they relate to physical things that you plan on putting, you know, very lifting heavy objects above your head, that simply reading about it isn't going to prepare you enough for. But in this community, I do understand and respect the fact that we do have such a reverence for books and we turn to books. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're a decentralized group. And so for want of sort of that book thing to tell us what to do, a book of instructions, you know, we turn to books, and I get that. I love that. I love books. I also do think that there are some things that I broach in the book that we've never really put down in black and white explicitly. And I wanted to put them down in black and white. I wanted
them
written
down. Put the rocks in your mouth.
Do what?
Do not put the rocks in your mouth.
Don't put them in you anywhere. Anywhere. you know, but I'm just like, if we don't say it out loud and often and where people are listening, what are we saying it? You know, are we saying it loudly enough? Are we saying it correctly? The fact that there are people that do shroud themselves in the security of our community of people that legitimately hold certain beliefs, and they come into the community and they commit fraud and they take your time and they take your money and they take your house or whatever. You know, there are bad actors. There's bad faith people in the community. And if you don't say that out loud, where people are going to listen and put it in black and white and stand behind it, there's just a certain level of, did we say it? Are we truly preparing people for the realities? I feel like there's a lot of, and I say it often in the book, in my book, there's a lot of books that will teach you the basics, but even in your book, you're pretty clear. If you're looking here to learn the, like if you're looking to have your hand held about the basics of spellcraft or the basics of certain things, like there's plenty of other books for that. This is a book about other things that are also important that you need to know. And
one star.
Yeah.
Why wasn't this book about giraffes? I was looking for a book about giraffes.
I'm trying really hard. So I'm not looking at my own reviews. I know they're out there.
You will.
All I know is that my publicity team is happy with them. But I am also a reader of books. And so I'm on Goodreads and Amazon and stuff. And I just, the people on those websites, man, it's, there's this weird scale that there's this weird like thing that people do with their reviews. Like they hoard these stars or something. I don't get it. Yeah. Yeah. It's, if it's a one-star review, it tends to be something like what you said, you know, I wrote a book about gardening and somebody comes in and says, why wasn't this book about giraffes? It's a clearly superior subject, giraffes. Well, this is a book about gardens. Exactly. Where are the giraffes? One star. Five-star reviews, alternatively, tend to just be like, good job. That read the book. Five stars.
Well, and that's something that I kind of wanted to talk about in mine was, I think people need to stop reading book reviews.
Please stop.
I think book reviews are kind of a waste of time, everybody. So I have to tell you something. That's,
yes.
This is a confession.
Okay.
Inciting a Riot listeners. I don't like blurbs. I think blurbs are... Do readers read blurbs? Because I don't as a reader. And I never have. And I didn't realize that blurbs were so important until I became an author. And I consciously didn't get any blurbs for The Witch's Path. Just to see what would happen.
Really?
So I'm doing...
Mm-hmm. Wait, do you not have blurbs?
Nope. There's not a blurb. Do you want to see?
You know what? I haven't seen, I don't, I mean, I've seen the PDF. Oh, now is that the ARC or is that the final copy?
This is the final. I just got it yesterday. This is the first time I've held my own book, everybody.
I'm allegedly getting mine next week.
Right. And I don't know, like, is this like a weird, terrible oversight or is it a flex? Like, what is happening here?
And oh, it's,
it wasn't,
you know,
I wasn't
it's a flex.
I wasn't super conscious of it. It actually has much more to do with like my introversion and my imposter syndrome, because I remember when Traditional Wicca came out and the acquisitions editor was like, okay, time to go get some blurbs. And I was like, I don't know anybody. Are you kidding? Why would anybody talk to me? And they were like, you need to reach out to Ray Buckland. You need to reach out to Deb Lip. And I'm like, those people are awesome and I'm scared of them. Uh-huh. And they were like, do it. And then finally they did it for me because I was just like, I was like, no. And then this time, nobody asked me to do it.
So you
and I was
didn't.
Like, so I just didn't.
And you got away with it.
I sure did. I guess. Because this is the final. Like,
I was scared. I feel like I over-asked people. I was mostly because I thought nobody was going to say yes. I thought nobody would. I know who I am. Like, I know who I am. I get me. I get what I do.
You're controversial, my friend.
I get it. And as such, I truly thought like nobody was gonna, I really thought this book was gonna not, I thought nobody wanted to read this book. I thought everybody couldn't wait to burn it. I thought it was gonna get just very largely ignored. And I was really shocked that I got the blurbs that I did. It was nice to see. I don't know what to do with that because I don't deal well with praise.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot happening there. Cause like on the one hand, folks will tell you like blurbs are really important for marketing. They're certainly useful. I mean, as a writer, it is such an honor knowing that people who I've read for years, who I really respect, are not just reading my books or acknowledging that I'm alive, but are actually enjoying them. Like that's really mind blowing. On the other hand, we started off kind of talking about publishing as an industry, and like blurbs are a marketing tool, and blurbs are like, there's kind of a quid pro quo thing happening there too. Like blurbs are currency amongst authers. And there's this
attitude.
You blurb
my book, I blurb your book.
I blurb yours.
I have you on my show. We agree never to talk shit about each other publicly. From now. Like there's the unspoken.
It's unspoken.
Unspoken rule that if you blur, you blurbed my book. So if I ever do anything, I get a free pass on your podcast.
Well, kind of. And like people will insist that this doesn't happen. And I don't even think that it happens consciously a lot of the time, but we do have this attitude. I mean, a blurb theoretically is an endorsement. Yeah. So if I write you a blurb, I'm not even just saying, hey, this book is really great for beginners. I really like how they tackled this complex issue. I also support all of the crazy things that they do on Facebook. Or, right? Like we have this idea that like you're never just talking about the book. You're always talking about the person.
We have stopped. We can no longer separate art from artist. And there's a good thing about that. And there's a bad thing about that.
Yes. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but I am saying that it's a complex thing.
It is a complex thing.
And if as a reader sitting in Barnes & Noble or wherever trying to decide which book to read, that's what those blurbs mean something different for that person than they do to us on Twitter. So like when I open up like a bestseller, like a literary fiction, you know, New York Times bestseller, whatever novel, all I see is like pages and pages of praise. And overwhelmingly, it's from people who I don't know and I don't care about. What I see is volume. Look at all these people, blah, 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 blah. As I, you know, as I read more fiction and grew up and, you know, studied literature and whatever, those blurbs became meaningless to me because I was like, this is all just senseless marketing.
Yeah.
Let me actually just like skip that stuff and get to the novel itself.
It's interesting that you got no blurbs. And I feel like the blurbs that I got or the blurbs that I used, especially like on the book, I was really conscious, like the top blurb that I used was from Ross Blotcher, who is the co-host of Oh No, Ross and Carrie, which is a...
You got to pick which blurbs you got to use?
I got to pick which ones went on the cover. Yeah.
Oh, cool. No, that didn't happen. I don't think that happens for us.
Oh, I got full contractual cover approval.
Check you out. Continue, sorry.
Meg Ellison made sure that
I love Meg.
Yes.
I love Meg.
Yeah. But I've said on Twitter, and I'm going to keep saying it until the heat death of the universe. If you want to be a writer, you need to make friends with writers, and you need to make friends with writers who are farther along in their career and better than you.
In other genres.
In other genres. And you need to be prepared to have your writing ripped to shit. Like you need to be ready to be vulnerable. Like you need to be ready to be vulnerable, and you need to be okay with the fact that you're going to surround yourself with people that are better than you, because that's going to make you better. You need to let your ego die. Your ego needs to die if you want to be a better writer. But that's true with just about anything. I'm just going to go back to fitness for a second because I feel like it's a really easy example to lean on. If you don't let your ego die and you walk into a gym and you try to load up that squat rack with a whole bunch of 45 pound weights and you pound that Bang energy drink and you dip into that squat, you are not going to come up. You are not going to stand back up if your ego's involved.
I always use, folks who know me know that I use a lot of music analogies because I'm a guitar player. I went to music school. I dropped out of music school because that's what one does.
Sure.
I'm not actually a jazz guitarist, but I went to school for jazz guitar. It's part of the reason I dropped out, right?
She really liked La La Land.
In in jazz, there's this concept of like of cutting and the cutting contest. And that's this idea of like going to a club with your instrument, playing, taking solos, doing it in front of an audience, doing it in front of other players. And let me tell you what, they will tell you what they think. And they don't care about your feelings. My professors did this to me. The bands I was in did this to me. And it is brutal. And
I was raised in poetry slam nights.
That is the point. The point, that's why it's called cutting, right? Like if you cannot survive that, and you're doing it in clubs, right? You're doing it in front of the best musicians in the world, and feelings has no, isn't it funny? Like feelings, right? There's no crying in baseball.
And
there's
what's
no feelings
great
in jazz.
Is when you do that kind of environment, you did it in music. I did it in like poetry. Poetry was my big thing for many, many years. And, you know, I would go to slam nights, and some nights I killed. Some nights I would come in first. I'd get all the snaps, you know, you go home with the whatever. And then the next weekend I bombed. I would try some new poem and I thought I was hot shit and it wasn't really worked out very well. And I thought I was saying something real deep and it was garbage and the audience knew it and called me out on it.
You never get to be on top for long. It's always
you're never
like
done. You're never done.
You're never done. You're never done. Like, you can always bomb the next album.
Yeah.
It's one of, like, we're harsh on musicians, but it's even harsher within like the scenes themselves and then amongst players. And you can think about like jazz in some ways, like jazz is America's classical music,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Tra-la-la. But it's also like a very niche in some ways today. And I can remember like freshman, like big band and combo. And we had like artists in residence and, you know, we had Branford Marsalis and we had like all these folks who would come and they would actually play with us. And I remember at one point the artist in residence turning to me and just said, "Why are you even here?" And that was it. That was it. Like, no advice for getting better, no support, no like, "Oh, good effort, everybody," right? Like, it was, "Why are you even here? Like, why are you even fucking here?" And that was how my music professors talked to me. And that's how musicians talk to each other. And like, don't talk to me about how mean the witch world is. Like,
no, don't.
It's nothing.
But two things, because I just want to finish the thought that got us here about the blurbs. The cover blurbs that I chose, I was just really conscious. The top blurb that I chose was from Ross Blotcher, co-host of Ono, Ross and Carrie, which is very famously a skeptics podcast, a skeptical investigation podcast, where they go and they discuss, you know, claims of paranormal abilities and cults and all sorts of stuff. And they do it from a very specific perspective. And I've known them for years, but I never expected that they would, one, read the book, two, like the book, or three, endorse the book. Because it's on its face value, it would ostensibly go against kind of what you would think that their show would be about, but they loved the book. Ross ended up writing the blurb for it and wrote a really lovely review for it. But I put that on the cover because I wanted people to understand that this is going to be, people who know Ross and people who know that show are going to then understand that this is a different kind of book written for a different kind of magical seeker. That to say, yeah. I think that blurbs serve the duty of, if you happen to know who the person is blurbing, then it means something to you. But otherwise, I think it's all just, look at how many people love my book. All these other people loved my book. So therefore, you must love my book. So you should buy this book. I think I might take a page out of your book, though, which is that blank page in the beginning. I might see if I can get away with no blurbs for my second book.
I think it's interesting.
How freeing.
I'm doing social science, everybody.
How freeing.
I'm not saying that this is how it should be. As I said, part of this is my like deep, like kind of clinical introversion.
So when I write my review for your book on like Instagram or whatever, it's just going to be a blank space with just my name at the bottom.
Yeah.
My Firelight's review of The Witch's Path by Thorn Mooney. And I'll have quotes and then a big blank space.
What if you read it, everybody? Like, what if you just went out and read it? Yeah, I don't know.
Go read it.
Well, and I was thinking about that, kind of thinking about another question. In reading your book, one of the things you do, and I can't think of the quote directly, but it's something where you say something like, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm kind of a bad news first person. Like, you tend to start sections with, here's a bunch of stuff that you've probably heard and why it's wrong. Here's what's actually going on. Like, you do that kind of throughout the book, which is great. Uh-huh. But obviously, like, that says something about who you're writing for.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking about audience. Like, who are we writing for? Because it sounds to me like a lot of the times, and you've got a skeptic's blurb on your cover, it sounds like you're writing primarily to kind of disabuse people of things.
Yes.
Which got me thinking, who the hell am I writing for? So am I, like,
you know, the funny
thing
is I feel like the people that read my book would read your book. Like,
I think
next.
They might.
Like, I feel like they would read your book next, because neither book I feel like babies people about the introductions of witchcraft. I feel like both books challenge you on the rest of the aspects of living this life. You know, you from a spiritual path and me from a cultural path. Like, you know, what does it mean to live in this community? What does it mean to be a witch? Well, what does it mean to be a witch means more than just red candle for passion, yellow candle for thought, yada, yada, yada. Like, there's a million and one of those books. And you know what? 101 introductory books make some publishers a lot of money, and they're going to continue to churn them out. So I don't need to write that book. Those books are already available for you. But Christ in a handbasket, that chapter on devotion bowled me the hell over. Like, it challenged me. And I'm like, I thought I was doing okay. I've been doing this for 20 years, almost 19 years. I feel like I'm okay at this by now. I'm an author too. Oh my gosh. Thorn Mooney just ripped me to shreds in this little book here. It wasn't anything that I didn't know, but it was just that friend that needed to get into my house and say, okay, I know that you say your house is clean, but have you seen that corner? Because when you clean your house, it doesn't mean just take all your shit and put it in that corner over there. Because that's what you're doing. And I'm like, oh man, maybe I need to, you know, sometimes people adopt a different word choice and it just reorients you. And when you called it devotion, because I've, you know, for years, I'm like, well, I don't want to focus on this other thing. You know, let's talk about practice.
We think it's
and
about gods.
Yes.
Not about gods, everybody.
And I just love the openness of the idea of devotion. It's romantic, it's spiritual, it's religious, but it could be for anything. If the crux of your practice is saying hello to that river every time you pass it, you must locate the core of that craft and do the work that it requires. If the crux of your practice is creating art, then you need to go make space and make that art. And you need to do it with intention, and you need to do it with ecstasy, and you need to do it with, like, a man with his head on fire seeks water.
So that chapter probably took me like 6 months to write.
I can tell. It's very careful.
I'm a very slow writer anyway. And that chapter.
Don't you write by hand?
I do.
I hate you. You and Barack Obama.
I also hate me. I always write to myself. Like, I write the things that I want and I need. And one thing, like, kind of the crux of that chapter, and this is my stuff. This is my personal baggage right here for a second. I have an academic background in religious studies. Mm-hmm. I'm very passionate about that subject very broadly. I'm applying to PhD programs in religion right now. And it deeply, deeply bothers me that we are so intent today on social media to insist that witchcraft is not a religion. And I'm not saying that because I know what religion is or I know what people need. That's not what I'm kind of uncomfortable about. I'm uncomfortable because we don't seem to collectively acknowledge that our definition of religion is essentially Protestant. Like, what we're really saying is that, like, witchcraft isn't about worshiping a god, or witchcraft isn't about subservience, or witchcraft isn't about mindless ritual. And all of those things are true. Okay. But that doesn't mean that it's not religious. And it took me a long time to realize oh, I'm thinking about religion from a very different place because I have this background that I have. So let me reframe that. And that's what I'm doing in that chapter. And the reason that chapter happened and kind of why this thing bothers me, the same people who will tell you up and down that witchcraft isn't religious are often the same people complaining about why, like, witchcraft feeling shallow, or other people like, why are there so many dilettantes, or blah, 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 like people don't take it seriously. Well, if it's a craft, like it's a hammer, I mean, I put my hammer down when I don't need it and I don't think about it anymore. Like, of course it's shallow. If there's no devotion, if there's no meaning behind what you're doing, like if it's not for something that matters, because like if it's just about getting money, then once you have money, like what do you need it for?
Well, and you taking people down that path in your book by, you know, giving them the easy thing first. You talk about consecrating your tools. Okay, so you consecrated your tool this one time. First of all, I need to see that knife.
You want to see my knife?
I do want to see your knife. I also have my cheap, shitty knife that I got. But the, you know, you do kind of challenge us in the beginning of like, okay, so sure, yeah, you consecrated it and you got all the smoke and you did all the stuff and you made it all pretty and oh, we have a very similar knife.
It's very tiny.
Yes.
I bought it at a Renaissance festival when I was like 16 or 17, underage. It's like, it's a boot knife. I remember the guy who sold it to me at the booth was like, my wife's got one just like it. She puts it in her booth and she pulls it out at SCA meetings and cuts her whatever. And like, I was like, my 16 or 17 year old heart was just like, oh,
I would
so
also
beautiful.
Like a boot knife.
Right? Like it's little.
I have a very similar looking one. It's not the same one. I thought it was going to be the same one, but it's that very similar vibe.
And
but,
I don't,
you know, you talk about we consecrate it, but then what do we do? I mean, when was the last time you did anything with those tools? Not just like use them to cut something or ritually cut something, but when was the last time you spent time like cleansing the energy off of them? And
if you don't behave like something is sacred, then it's not sacred. It doesn't matter what it is.
Right. Right. I mean, it was sacred that one time, but
right. And if you're uncomfortable with the word religion or religious, that's fine. Find a different word. Right. But if you treat something like it's just about doing labor, it's just about getting something, you don't then get to complain that it doesn't like fulfill your deepest longings. And you know what I mean? Like a hammer has a job when you don't need the job anymore. And if witchcraft is just a lowercase c craft, then why do I need it if I like have my immediate needs met?
And there is, I mean, there's something to be said, and we both kind of talk about this, but there's something to be said that when you've been doing this a while, sure, there is an aspect to your big C craft that is in your everyday. There are things that you now do when you go to work that are part of your morning routine, that are part of your daily life, the easy example, you know, the way that you stir your coffee, the way that you do this or that or the other. It started off being an intentional magical act that you added as part of your practice and has now become the way that you do things. So sure, there is an argument to be made that there are a lot of ways that we incorporate craft into our daily lives that we just are very unconscious about. Now, however, there is also something to be said for reacquainting yourself with those practices. Why do you do them? You know, are they enough anymore? Maybe it's time to get more intentional about it.
When I want to make people mad, which I do, particularly folks in a certain generation.
I never do. I don't like making people mad.
You are totally... No, you are the Switzerland.
I am the Switzerland of the pagan community.
Mm-hmm. When I want to make people mad, I go on some like I don't really go on tirades necessarily on Twitter, but like when I make statements about there being a distinction between the sacred and the profane, because we spent the 80s and 90s in pagan publishing insisting that all things are magical, and I'm sorry, I don't think washing the dishes is sacred. Sorry, and I don't want it to be sacred, because sometimes the sacred and the magical are set apart for very good reasons. Uh-huh. if I just think everything in the mundane world is sacred, and I'm not saying it's not, or I'm not saying it doesn't have the potential to be, but if I just treat everything as sacred, that's the same thing as not doing anything.
Yes. Yes. If so many practices have gotten into your daily life in such a way that you're so unconscious of them and they're just the way that you're doing things, but you haven't thought about them in a long time, do they still mean what they meant to you when you added them to your practice?
Which is why I tell people, I realize you've been a witch for 20 years, but maybe read a beginner book and like cleanse your space and do a full moon ritual. See what happens.
Yes. But I'm going to be real honest. That's everything. Like, there was some advice that made a lot of people angry last year that was like, you want to be a YA author? Have you read anything published in YA in the last 3 years?
Yep.
Like, ew, no. I love this book that came out when, 20 years ago. I love da 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 da. Okay. Well, you're
why
not
do we need
up
anything?
With where we are.
Yeah. Why do we need anything since Scott Cunningham?
Right.
That's our like bastion of whatever. And I was talking to some friends earlier about this. Like, we will say all day long that there are too many beginner books on the market, but you know what? I don't have one that I like. I have no book to recommend. I'm serious. Like, I have no book that I can recommend to a seeker to my group without a caveat. Right? Like, oh, this has a really good chapter about whatever, but ignore this. Or, oh, like, here's this thing, but the correspondences are just plagiarized out of Scott Cunningham.
Yep.
I would love a beginner book that I didn't have to attach with a whole bunch of caveats.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like my caveats are like unique to my tradition or my thing. It's like the history is bad.
Yeah.
Or it assumes that you are, this is my favorite, right? Like, it assumes you want to be a practitioner. You know, like Wicca is one of those few religions, and I mean Wicca specifically, not witchcraft as a whole. You know, if I want to read about like Mormonism or Catholicism or Judaism, I can go to a Barnes & Noble and I can read a book about that that doesn't assume I want to sign up. Wicca doesn't have that.
No.
Every single book is like, chapter one, here's some bad history. Chapter two, here's how to do it, everybody. And like, frankly, those books are embarrassing to give to a parent, a boyfriend, a professor, a colleague. Like, and at best, I have like some texts that were written in like the 70s and 80s that are outdated. But like, are you really going to give your mom like, you know, the little Wicca guide of spells, blah, 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 blah? Like, yeah, it's a beginner book, but it's for a very particular sort of person.
Uh-huh.
So do we have enough beginner books? Because I don't think we do, because I still feel unserviced.
Well, and I kind of talk a little bit unserviced, she says with that look on her face.
I did say it.
She said it. And I kind of talk about this as well a little bit in discussing the nature of what a 101 book is versus what a 101 book is in our community. If I'm going to a college, if I'm going to take a course and I'm taking a 101 course, I'm reading a textbook. And a textbook in a 101 course is supposed to give me a generic understanding of, you know, a deep dive into a lot of aspects about this subject. It's written by multiple authors. It is peer reviewed. It's fact checked. It's deep dive. There's not a lot of perspective. There's not a lot of individual point of view in it. It's just sort of, here's how things are. Here's how things work. Here's why they work that way. And here's where you need to go next. And we don't do that. We do, here's this author's interpretation of their 20 witchcraft books that they read. And it would be better, I think, maybe if we did have at least a few 101 books that you could take to a school and teach, you know, I would like that. I would love Wicca for grownups.
The working title in my head is Grown Folks Wicca.
I would love that. Please. I would like to read that. And I would like to read versions of that for all of the different paths under our umbrella and, alongside us in the magical community. I would love to read those books. It would be nice because, you know, what makes somebody a witchy scholar? Well, that's really kind of hard to answer because we don't have
a background in scholarship.
Yeah, we don't
really have. I'm sorry, that's the controversial thing to say. But a background in scholarship, like reading a whole lot of occult books, does not make you a scholar. I'm sorry.
No, it does not.
Kind of like how me having lots of feelings in my heart didn't make me a jazz guitarist, right? Like,
you know, I want to ask about your book. You know, you begin the place, you begin the book in a really vulnerable place, and it's a very familiar place, and it immediately tells me who this book is written for. I know that you questioned that earlier, but I feel like the introduction of your book told me exactly who you were writing this book for, and it was for me. But you know, you were admitting to skipping holidays because other things took importance. I mean, you still participated, but did you really do them for yourself? You know, and I know that when I was writing Dabbler's Guide, I felt the pressure to balance authority with honesty, with personal contribution, with perspective. You were actually on my show earlier this year talking about the concept of expertise and what an expert is. But were you ever concerned that this might throw off a casual introductory reader, or were you confident that you were writing for a more experienced practitioner who knows what it's like to fall off the broomstick from time to time?
It's difficult because from a marketing perspective, you want to have the widest appeal that you can.
Sure.
Like, publishing is a game of numbers, and the fewer books you sell, the less likely it is that you will ever write another book, or that the book you do write will be in print in 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's just objectively true. Beginners buy books. Folks who are more advanced tend not to. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just objectively true.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's a couple of things. Sure. Like, why folks don't buy books, or why folks don't publish books?
People like us that have been here for 20 years plus, why aren't we buying as many witchcraft books?
I think a lot of it has to do with, I was kind of reflecting on this on Instagram the other day. Like, who are we writing for, and what do we write to? And I find increasingly folks with more advanced backgrounds who tend to occupy particularly leadership roles, their coven leaders or their teachers or whatever, they tend to read books as though they're imagining they're someone else. Like, would I give this to a beginner? Would this be good for my coven? Would this be good for whatever? Like, we very rarely read for ourselves. And I think on the one hand, that's because witchcraft is about doing, kind of our initial rant about how, like, the occult arts, magic, like, they're ultimately not learned from books. Like, they are, but they're not. Like, reading a book doesn't make you an occultist. So I think there's that element of having to do things. But I think too, at some point, we sort of collectively lose focus on the point of it all. Does that make sense? Like, you do whatever it is for so long, witchcraft or some other form of magical practice. And I think if you don't have it's like fitness. If you don't have very clear goals, then you're just going to the gym. And like, you'll be in maintenance mode. But if you are getting ready for a bodybuilding competition, or you decided you need to like focus specifically on your legs, or you're healing from an injury, you want to strengthen your lower back or whatever, your workout changes, right? Mm-hmm. We don't approach books that way most of the time. I think people don't learn to read that way. So we read very generically, and then we complain that books are generic.
I mean, I agree with you. I think that personally, I'm gonna be real honest. I went through several years of not reading any witchy books. It doesn't mean that I wasn't reading books that supported my craft, but I wasn't reading them coming out of pagan publishing. And I think it's because I just kind of got tired of reading the same book over and over and over again. And I think that people that have been practicing a while want something else, but they want something else from inside our community. You know, I want to hear about art history from a pagan's perspective. You know, I want to hear about physics from a pagan's perspective. I want to hear about geology from a pagan's perspective. And I'm so glad that some of that is starting to come out and be supported. It's not that it wasn't there, but it's that we didn't listen to it. It's that we didn't support it. We didn't share it because it challenged us, I think, a little bit too much. And I think the reason why more people are not writing air quotes more advanced books, and I almost don't like to use that the phrase in the context of this particular part of the conversation, because I feel like, you know, that's almost shady, but I just feel like we don't know what that would look like in our community. I just don't feel like we know what an advanced witchcraft book looks like that would be supported and shown to people. I mean, it's not like those don't exist, and it's not like they haven't been out there, and it's not like there aren't advanced witchy creators and, you know, podcasters and stuff like that, but it's that we haven't really ever supported that. I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. I think, kind of going along with that, thinking about advanced materials, part of it is that that stuff is out there, but we don't necessarily support it in publishing. So mm-hmm. like you brought up podcasts, there are lots of advanced practitioners of various traditions sharing their stuff, but it doesn't mean it's going to be effectively marketed as a book.
Right.
So like I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned geology, we can't not mention Kat Borealis, like who's had a podcast and has been on social media, doesn't have a book. Okay. But
not yet.
Okay. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Yeah. But sometimes it's about looking for different mediums. You know, I always kind of have to have a chuckle, and not that I expect people to have like consumed my whole body of work or whatever, but it's always funny. Like people will read my book and they'll go, oh my gosh, you need to like write a book about this thing. And I go, I've got 10 years of YouTube videos talking about exactly that thing. Like maybe change the medium.
Yeah.
Videos, podcasts.
Every now and then I get a tweet or an email or something. Oh, you should really talk about this. I'm like, I did.
I have. 7 years ago. Yeah. And I think it's because we're so accustomed to the idea that books are where authority lives. So it has to come in book form, right? Picture it didn't happen. Well, book or it doesn't exist.
Exactly. And I hate that because like, I feel like, and I'm almost scared at the sense of authority that having published a book is about to confer upon me. So maybe I should ask you, because this is not your first book. Do you feel like something changed about the way that people listened to you after your book came out?
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Do you like that? Because I'm a little nervous about it. I'm like, wait, I feel like I kind of go out of my way to say, I mean, I have an entire chapter called Can I Make Shit Up? And yes, you can, because
yes,
I did.
Yes, you can.
Like I did. Like the spells in the back of my book, I made those up. Like, and you can too. And like, I'm just a little scared that like people, you know, that it's now going to be like Firelight's way of doing things is the way that I do things. And I'm nervous about that.
So a couple of things about that, because I've thought about this, and I'm writing something for my own Patreon page about like expectations as an author, like moving from the first book to the second book. What did I think was going to happen as an author to my life, to my practice, whatever, when traditional Wicca was coming out, and what's changed on book number two? And so much has changed. And some of those things, when I was writing traditional Wicca, I was very, very anxious about that, especially because my own particular community, like initiatory Wicca, has a reputation for being, you know, kind
clicky,
of mean,
shady,
clicky,
quiet.
Well, or even just like really hostile to outsiders. Well, and I came up during the 90s with Amber and Jet, that listserv. Like, I don't know if you ever spent any time on Amber and Jet, but it was supposedly...
I mean, I was on Witchvox around the time that people, I think, were, like, leaving that, or that was dying or something.
I mean, there were listservs available, and Amber and Jet was the biggest. And the whole premise was, like, here's a place where you can go if you're interested. You can find a coven. You can ask questions. It was supposed to be kind of like for seekers. But if you showed up and actually asked questions, you were essentially just called an idiot and told to go fuck yourself.
That was my experience. But that has not changed.
No, it hasn't. That's why
that has not changed.
That's why it's so funny watching people get so mad about TikTok. And I'm like, how is this any different than live?
Oh my God. Oh, see, I'm going to be real honest. I was a little shady about TikTok. And then I got on TikTok and I was like, this is just Tumblr from 2015, which was just Twitter from 2012, which was just Facebook from 2009, which was
we always think we've just invented
Witchvox from 2006. Like, I mean, this is nothing new. We have been doing the same shoot from the hip you know, I've read 5 books, so now I think that I should write my own book. You know, oh my God, exactly. We've been doing that since we've been a thing.
Yeah. So I was really nervous because, like, my tradition is very important to me. I've got close connections, like, through my lineage and just my friends and people who I love. And I was just like, what are people going to think of? And I had so many people reading that book for me before it was published to let me know, like, is this just like literary suicide that I'm about to commit? Like,
you know, I did the same thing. I mean, I sent my book to like 35 people.
And so that was kind of my expectation. And there were some things that happened. There were definitely people who were like, she's an oath breaker, who didn't read it at all. It's just offensive.
Who doesn't read your book.
Yeah. It's just offensive that an initiate would write anything that by itself is oath breaking.
Sure.
And then, you know, but I was very surprised by how well received it was. And I make this joke very frequently, like literally there are people who gave teen Thorn shit on Amber and Jet who are now like really super like praising the book. And that felt like some major validation. And I'm not saying I wasn't like a shithead as a teenager. Okay.
Right. Who wasn't?
But I was a child. I was just like objectively a child.
Yes.
So like that was very cool. But, you know, it didn't have this kind of earth-shaking, obvious impact that I think I was A, worried about, or B, like hoping for, right? Because nobody writes a book that they want. Nobody writes a book that they want people to ignore.
Sure.
Like, all of us kind of secretly or not so secretly hope that this is going to be our big break. I'm not going to have to work an office job. Oh, I'm finally going to have that platform I want. Like, you have to have an ego to write a book. Like, full stop.
100%. Oh yeah. There's something about writing a book, doing a podcast, having a YouTube channel, you know, whatever it is, like.
If we really didn't care, we wouldn't post it on Instagram. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, obviously I think that I've got something to contribute.
Exactly. Right.
It's worth a damn.
And when that part didn't happen, when I didn't instantly become like famous or like people really weren't talking about me, there was part of my ego that was just like, oh, well, that sort of sucks. But then there was part of me, a bigger part of me that was super relieved.
Yeah.
And in writing the second book, it was actually like very liberating because I realized like people are either going to read it or not read it. It's going to be out of print at some point anyway. And like there are thousands of books out there.
Yeah.
Like no one author can really ruin anything.
Yeah.
So what if
you're not going to get picked up by Oprah? You're not going to be, you know,
I'm not going to be on Oprah. I still have to go to my cubicle.
The stakes in our community publishing are so much lower. It's not like, it's not like, I don't know, romance. Romance is the number one literary genre.
Well,
it's not like you're
about
to write a book that's about to be read by 500,000 people in the next month, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Like a Llewellyn print run is like 3,000 to 5,000 books.
Yes.
Right. So like we're talking, I mean, like that's not even worth printing at like a HarperCollins.
No. Oh my God. The book deals that we get in this industry, by and large, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's rarities here or there that get picked up by bigger publishers. He says, having been published.
Sure.
But still, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know,
they're comparatively tiny.
The print
blips.
Runs, the advances, the entire bit of it. I mean, my God.
Oh, well, advances. Right. Yes. So now that I know that, and I know, you know what? I pay my mortgage with my day job. I can go to festivals because I can afford to buy the ticket. Yeah. It's not because I'm an author. It's because I work a day
job. You're
not
getting flown first class to go to.
I sure am not. Nope. I make
Saskatchewan Pride Day.
I make negative money being a pagan presenter, everybody. Okay. That's just true. And that's true for all of us. Okay.
You know, at the height of my podcast a few years ago, when I was getting invited to go to all those pagan pride events in the area, and I was going like once a weekend, every weekend, you know, for the entirety of the summer. Yeah. I'm paying for that. But I'm paying for the privilege to go.
Yeah. Well, and if I'm taking off of work, which I am, like I'm losing that money every day. So yeah, like this is a courtesy. This is a favor. This is because I love this community. This is because I think it's going to be enjoyable. But given all of that, why not write a book that I actually think is meaningful? because let's be real, like if I was going to write, you know, like Thorn Mooney's like 100 spells that really work, that book might make me a quick advance, but it's going to be out of print in 5 years. It's going to be a blip and whatever.
Because someone else is going to write 2,000 exactly. spells, and someone else is going to write, you know.
And there are some notable exceptions, okay?
Judica Illish, we can all talk about Judica Illish.
We tend to think in exceptions, but we don't realize how many books are published each year and how many just never make it to the Barnes & Noble.
It's that very first thing that we were talking about right at the beginning of this conversation. You only think of Mariah Carey. You don't think of all the other people that can sing just like her.
Yep.
There's so many people that can that are doing just the same exact thing, but they just haven't met the right person. You just don't know that they've been doing it yet. I mean, it, you know...
Yeah.
Every now and then I get somebody like in a comment section somewhere that's like, where have you been? Oh my God. Why
here
am I
here for
just,
20 I mean, years? I get that. This is my favorite. And I know you don't get this one. Wow. You're a Wiccan, but you're actually smart. And I'm like, maybe you're not talking to the right people, my friend. Like I've been making videos for more than 10 years. Like I've been here for literal decades. Like I have a, like, yeah. You're actually smart. I'm like, yeah, I get that. The other thing I get that's related to that is, well, are you sure you're really Wiccan? Because your attitudes are so like aligned more with traditional witchcraft. And I'm like, maybe you just don't know about Wicca. Like maybe did it occur to you that maybe you actually just know less about Wicca than you think
you do? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's okay to admit that we don't know a lot of stuff. We haven't been taught very well.
No.
We haven't been.
So like kind of thinking about all of that stuff.
Yes.
We write the book that we need. So like I've got a lot of questions for you, okay? But like we talked about goals.
Yes.
And being around for a while, okay? And I think you in particular often occupy a space of controversy. Which is good. I think controversy is important sometimes. You've seen like petty gripes versus like legitimate gripes, things that are real, things that are just annoying. And I'm wondering, like, given that you've been here for so long and now you're an author, like, how do you tell the difference between like the petty stuff and what's going to like be important? Like, what are the real things that we should be mad about? And how can you tell? Because everything feels equally loud in the moment.
Everything does feel equally loud in the moment, and social media makes things feel extra loud and extra important and extra urgent, especially when a big enough creator has a bug in their craw about it. And I'm going to be real honest, and you know this about me. I also started off as a young child. I mean, I wasn't a teenager being online, but I was in college being online, and I was from a very sheltered small town, East Texas community. I was a dumb idiot person when I became Firelight Online.
You were a child. You were a child.
I was a child in many ways. And so I also...
You were not dumb.
I did not understand the difference between a petty gripe and what is actually an important cause to be righteously angry about. However... And now on the other side of this, hopefully, and I do have some perspective on this. I think the difference is I ask the reader a lot to consider the spectrum of potential harm on a given topic. What is the potential for harm here? And I at least try my writing and my platform to give you a lot of different ways to think about what harm can look like and how big harm can be and how pernicious harm can be and how quiet harm can be. So someone's internal petty gripes to creators that don't like each other, to authors that don't like each other, you know, someone that's mad because some TV show didn't get a portrayal of witchcraft in right in the sense of what they think witchcraft should look like, those tend to not really have the greatest potential for harm. I think that we can tend to find what is important by going outside of our community and seeing if that situation is part of a greater macrocosm of issue of society and of harm. But, you know, you have an academic background in religion. I have an academic background in sociology. So I tend to think in terms of society. But I ask us to look outside of ourselves. So what is the potential for harm in certain things? Well, you know, racism is a problem. Homophobia is a problem. Transphobia is a problem. Those things exist in our communities. Those things exist outside of our community. What is the potential for harm? Well, you know, X, Y, and Z thing. Now, who's to say, you know, I guess the other part of that is then I leave it up to, you know, then you have to leave it up to the person to, I guess, hopefully decide on their own and hope they make good choices about where they're going to spend their energy and where they're going to spend their time and what, you know, what they're going to decide is then important. But I try to have conversations that are bigger than a single moment. Sometimes a topic comes up. Like on Tuesday, I'm having a conversation with some trauma counselors. You know, we talk a lot about shadow work and we talk a lot about, you know, so, and every now and then, you know, topics come into the zeitgeist and it gives us an opportunity to capture that, you know, while it's riding its viral moment, it's a good time to talk about it because people are talking about it. So it's a good time to provide the perspective. Sometimes things rise up in the moment and you realize, oh, this is just a moment. Maybe I don't need to be a part of that. this is just someone with a large enough following had a little moment and they need to get over it. And then because they have a big enough following, we all have to have discourse about it. And, you know, you just realize eventually you don't need to have discourse.
For me, a lot of that, and I think this is even true thinking about like the first book versus the second book stuff we were talking about. For me, my perspectives and my sense of scale really shifted when I became a Title I classroom teacher. Mm. So for folks who aren't familiar with Title I, right, like I'm talking about like schools, mostly in urban areas, 100% poverty rates, right? Like everybody gets a free lunch, et cetera. Like we're talking about impoverished spaces. Mm-hmm. And my sense of what was important shifted when I began working with children living in these spaces. And it got to be, you know, there's kind of this attitude online collectively that like, we have this idea that silence is violence, which I think is true to an extent. Okay. But often like thinking about those things, like that, those kinds of catchphrases often initiate when we're talking about, I mean, like we're talking about like Nazis, right? We're talking about like world wars and whatever. And I think we kind of use those phrases so liberally now when sometimes silence is exhaustion. Or silence is I'm focused on other things. And I remember being harshly criticized when I was on Pathos for not writing about trans inclusivity in my blogs. And from my perspective at the time, a lot of that was like, well, we've got trans writers who are writing, like maybe my job is to elevate these people. Mm-hmm. Like, why am I... like, do I have to be writing a blog about this issue myself? And the kind of the resounding Twitter discourse seemed to be, well, silence is violence. Of course, you need to be writing blogs. And my response to that was, well, nobody else is writing about education. Mm-hmm. Like, I spend 10-hour days like dealing with social workers and cops. And I just watched a police officer like drag a 7-year-old down the street. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like, and coming home and crying every day after work because of like these awful things that I was seeing in my city. And I don't know, like there's this idea that if you're not, especially as an author, especially as somebody with a platform, if you're not providing commentary on things, the assumption is that you are like on the side of the oppressor or you're in opposition. You're fundamentally like a part of the problem. And I'm not saying that those things aren't true. Okay. I'm just saying that like, you know, we have so many hours in a day and so much energy. And I think that sometimes like allowing people the grace of you can care about all things, but you can't put equal amounts of energy into all things. And like, that was a big part of the reason I stepped back from blogging and why I'm like increasingly stepping back from things like festival presentation and social media, et cetera. Like it's been very gradual. But a lot of that is just, do I have a sense of scale here? Like when I'm outraged, because there are some things that I can immediately impact, right? The children in my classroom, what am I doing to help them? I don't know. And then just like not having time when I get home for like pagans being mad about like, you know, the second version of the craft or whatever, or like, I don't know, just like whatever yeah. people are mad about, like, how can you not know, like this, like somebody said a bad thing on Facebook and blah, 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 blah. And now
we
whatever.
All have to have discourse about it. And
we all, and,
and I, you know, part of that is I understand that we all, you know, just like we all thought that our dicks were big enough, our more metaphorical dicks were big enough to go write a book, you know, just like we all had enough of an ego to put ourselves out there on YouTube and podcasts and this and that and the other, like, you know, we have enough ego about ourselves to sort of cobble together a platform. So I understand that part of that does come with a responsibility to at times say something.
Absolutely.
However, as someone who I think has the public image of being professionally outraged about everything at all times, you're right. You simply can't be. One, you cannot know enough about every possible topic to be correctly outraged about the right piece of it. You can't. And you know, what I mean to say there is, you know, issues come up and sometimes knowing why you're upset is the more important thing. Like what the context, the nuance, what actually happened, what are the facts of the matter and not just the optics of it, right? The Chair just came out this weekend and I was one of those people that went ahead and binged it. I don't know if you've binged it yet, but I know that
not
you said
yet.
In academic spaces, so I'm sure you will very soon. But a large part of the plot revolves around a teacher doing a dumb thing in the context of a classroom, in the context of a lecture on fascism, makes a stupid gesture. And that gesture is the thing that gets recorded by somebody with a smartphone and turned into a meme that then gets this tenured professor who everybody seemed to love up until this point, who had been fairly unproblematic, or at least acceptably problematic, suddenly in a matter of like days, this tenured professor loses everything. And you almost feel sorry for the tenured professor. But the thing is, there's this conversation that the writers of that show are having about the nature of modern outrage and the way that some of these topics get so big so fast and how they're not even really about the topic anymore. They're just about getting to be outraged. The whole world is on fire. Everyone is scared and angry and upset. And a lot of people are scared and angry and upset because their home is literally in danger of burning down, or they haven't had a steady enough job in 3 years, or they have medical bills, they have student debt, they have a sick family member, you know, they're mad and scared about a thing. And then your thing comes up and it just gets to be catharsis for their outrage. They're out. They just want to scream at God. They just want to go to the mountaintop and scream at God. And your thing is the reason why they get to be angry.
I think that's part of it. And I think too, like, I don't think folks have a sense of, I keep saying like a sense of scale, but I don't think, you know, we see the most obvious thing. We see it if it's on Facebook. If it's not on Facebook, it may as well not be real. But, you know, I mean, I've received plenty of critique for like who I'm friends with, who I hang out with, what events I go to, what podcasts I'm on, right? Like every time I agree to do anything, I got somebody at me, like adding me somewhere. Like that's just true. And it's true for all of us. Okay. And to me, because, yeah, I agree, like integrity is important, ethics matter, et cetera. But to me, that says to me that the most ethical thing is to overwhelmingly not participate in those things.
Social media. The thing is, I don't think you're wrong there, because what I'm coming to find out in my elder millennial age is that, like, I don't know enough about most things to be angry about them immediately with the urgency that the internet wants.
Yes.
I don't know enough about them. We don't have enough facts. Seeing a tweet and then spending my next 72 hours spinning out into a rage because of a tweet.
Yeah. And I mean, this happened to me.
I'm sorry, my anxiety and I can't handle it. I just can't handle it.
This happened to me really recently. So as you know, being on Instagram, there's this whole thing now with like fake accounts and scam accounts and people pretending to be other people. Well, apparently, you know, Thorn the Witch with like two N's and three E's and whatever started posting anti-vax material on Instagram. So now people are like, I'm hearing rumors about how I'm anti-vax, I'm anti-science. My inbox is like, how dare you? Right? Like I've canceled my pre-orders, blah, blah. And
are you
folks,
really?
That happens. Yes. And like, that's not the first time somebody heard something about something. And so we say that we want receipts, but we don't. We don't. We say that we care about facts and I've got screenshots and whatever, but I don't. Yeah. Like it's just. And my response to these things is, you know what? What if I didn't do pagan festivals?
Ooh.
Because like we know which ones to be mad about.
I just got
but
so
we don't,
horny for that phrase. What if
but
I just
we
didn't
don't,
do it?
Yeah, what if I just didn't do it? Like, because we know who we're supposed to be mad at, but we don't know about the private stories. We don't know about like what happens behind closed doors. We don't know. And overwhelmingly, we don't listen. Like heaven forbid.
But then on
we
the
hear
flip
opinions.
Side of that. You know, to figure out what you should actually be angry about, then the example that I keep using is Kenny Klein, because when that came out, suddenly people came out of the woodwork.
And I was in Blue Star.
So people came out of the woodwork in comment section, my comment section. I remember that was the biggest article I'd ever written. And all I did was like copy some facts from a news story. And was like, hey, Kenny Klein was arrested, yada, yada, yada. Here's what he was being accused of, et cetera, et cetera. My comments, I mean, I don't think I've ever had so many comments on a blog post before of, oh, yeah, we've always known. Oh, yeah, we've always known. And I'm like, okay, well, I feel like that would be a thing to be outraged about publicly and angry and loudly. Like, there are things to be angry about.
Yeah, like my experience, like being a woman who's been in abusive relationships, who's been the subject of that, is that when you say things, people aren't interested.
Yeah.
And the people who we are supposed to be mad at for those things, often it's really we're mad about something else.
Yes.
Like it's convenient to hate this person.
Yes.
We say it's for X reason, but really it's for Y reason.
Yeah.
So what I've learned is, you know what? And I think this is kind of like a generally good way to live one's life. We are all sort of terrible. It's like we're talking about ego.
Yes.
All of us have problems.
Yes.
Like we're all sort of terrible. And I feel like it's healthy to give people the benefit of the doubt insofar, as you said, we're evaluating the reach of harm.
Yes.
And it's become my impulse to give people the benefit of the doubt. But as I am in as I am a public witch longer, I feel like I will become more, not reclusive, but I have some contracts for events that I agreed to do in 2019, and that's probably going to be the end of it for a little while.
Yeah.
Like I'll still go to events because I've been going to events and being in witchcraft communities for almost 25 years at this point. I'm not going to stop, but it's different when you go as a presenter. And you know, there's some things about people that I just don't want to know, you know, and I don't know. It's easy to be mad about low hanging fruit, but I think when you really look at anybody,
easy to be mad about low hanging fruit.
If you really look at anybody long enough, I just,
there are still things that like, you know, I got to see some pages of a book that's about to come out and it's just, apparently we decided that transphobia is a thing that we're going to try to market in 2022, I guess, again, because nobody learned from Lisa Lister.
Did we? I mean, Lisa Lister, that was a massively like best-selling book.
Sure.
So what were we supposed to learn?
What were we supposed to learn? If we're all mad about it and our outrage makes it become a bestseller, what
exactly
did we do?
What did we cause?
But I was like, you know... Sure, I guess it's low-hanging fruit to say, hey, just to let you know, trans men are men, trans women are women, there is no place for trans exclusion in the craft. This platform is not a safe space for transphobia. That's pretty low hanging fruit. And yet I still feel like every now and then, I still feel like sometimes if that situation presents itself to you, sometimes it's still like, we just need to say it.
Oh,
sometimes
absolutely.
You need to say it out loud and publicly and in black and white, because if you don't, and you don't long enough, sure, eventually people wonder, like, well, what do you think on this? Why haven't you ever said
absolutely
anything about this? So there is a balancing act there. There's a balancing act.
I think part of that balancing act, though, has to be, you can make that statement and you should make that statement, but you shouldn't do it while attaching Lisa Lister's Amazon listing.
No.
You know what I mean? Or sharing.
Go read this terrible book.
Go read this terrible article. Like, you realize that clicks are money. Like, they're literally money.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you're mad about X person in the community. Then why are you sharing their shit?
It's always hilarious when, like, someone says a terrible thing on a YouTube video or something like that. Or, like, a TikTok from a big enough account where, like, their TikTok account is monetized.
Yes,
or something.
It's monetized,
and then, like,
everybody.
Suddenly, oh my God, baby, I hate to you know what we were talking about earlier, how blurbs and all of this stuff is, like, carefully calculated, like theater?
Yep.
You know, some people just say controversial shit because it makes them money.
They do. And then they'll flat out tell you, I say controversial shit to make me money. Watch as people reblog my shit and I make money. And what do? We reblog it.
I interviewed Christian Day 1,000 years ago. And I remember I had a long list of questions and I was ready to just rip that guy anew. I really was. I was coming in guns blazing. And he came on my show and he said, oh, I say shit because I know it'll get attention and it'll sell my books and it'll sell tickets to Hexfest or whatever. Yeah, no, that's exactly why I say things. Like, I just say controversial stuff because it gets attention. I don't actually mean any of it. And I don't know, maybe I do. But, you know, mostly I'm just saying it to raise awareness for my business so that it makes me money. And I was like, oh, you just said it out loud. You just said it.
I think about that when I think about,
it really takes a lot of the thunder out of your righteous anger when it's like, oh, you know exactly what you're doing and you did it on purpose.
Well, and wasn't that kind of the spirit behind so much of, like, the political season of the last couple of years? It has very little to do with, like, truth or whatever, and more about just being a marketer.
Yeah.
Knowing how the market works. And,
yes.
You know, I remember taking, like, journalism 101 in college, and, like, day one, if it bleeds, it leads. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That's common. That's like, yeah. Day one. If it bleeds, yeah. It leads. If you write something, and I know this from being a Pathos writer. Mm-hmm. If I say something mean about somebody, which I go out of my way to never do. Okay. But, like, you know, you don't know sometimes who you're going to upset. But if I say something that people think is controversial, that's when I'm getting a check from Pathos, because that's when I get the hits.
Mm-hmm.
That's when my YouTube, like, my most popular YouTube videos are the ones where people think that I've said something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can be mad about whoever or whatever, but you're still putting money in their pockets. Uh-huh. If you don't approach it with that knowledge, like, clicks equal money, period.
Yeah. And there needs to be a different way to have that conversation. And I think that the older that you get and the more perspective you have, when you're young, and I'm not saying that, you know, either of us is, like, old, but we're at least old enough to start having some perspective about things.
I make that grunting noise when I sit up out of a chair now, right? Like,
when I wake up in the morning, sometimes my lower back hurts because I slept wrong and I have to, like, consciously in my head visualize how I'm going to get out of bed so that my lower back doesn't hurt. So I'm there with you. But there, I now have at least enough perspective to know that if I'm feeling angry about something, before I get swept up in it, I need to go learn more about it. I need to go decide on the anger.
And sometimes the very best thing that you can do, like, as somebody out in the community, is to simply block and unfollow.
Mm.
You don't share things. You don't make a tirade. Like, this is a very WASPy kind of, like, don't say it out loud answer, right? Like, my WASPy family would be proud of me, right? Like, you
make it witchy. Speak little, listen much.
Right. Speak little, listen much. It's just like WASP values repackaged, okay? But, like, all attention equals money, whether that's good or bad. So if you really want to punish somebody, you pretend they don't exist.
Yeah.
You block them, you mute them. If somebody, like, if somebody is terrible, right? Like, you don't buy their books, you don't, like, whatever. And just, I think that's what we all need to be doing. Like, make your individual informed choices, talk with whoever you need to. But be aware, like, when you, I mean, this is very, like, kind of magic sort of 101. If you speak something, it becomes real. And I think we need to kind of be careful where we're allowing our attention to fall.
You wrote, if your witchcraft isn't setting you apart in some way, I would frankly question its effectiveness.
I did.
I don't ever want to get a tattoo, but if I did, I would probably put that somewhere, like on like a thigh or something. That's a very good line.
Yeah. One, I had a conversation with Levi Rowland recently, who I think is really brilliant. And Levi, of course, is attached to some controversy in our community because of who he's friends. Like, he just had a book on astrology come out. That's great. But because he's releasing it, you know, like, because of his associations, like, you are who you hang with. I write about this too. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about that, like, how does this stuff impact you? How does this whatever? Because I hear, you know, not just about him, but, like, I've heard this about myself, right? Like, oh, I like that you have this idea, or I like your perspective, but you follow X person on Twitter. You're downline from X person. You're associated with X person. Like, how do you deal with that? And what Levi said to me when I was talking about him in particular, he said, well, I'm not a Methodist. Like, why are they supposed to like me? And I just thought, huh. I'm not a Methodist. Yeah.
That's true. It's true. Though I will say, you know, after you've been online long enough, sometimes you're just, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes you followed someone because for like a week you liked what they said, and then you got you followed them, and then you,
oh, totally.
You know, 3 years later they said something terrible and you're like, wait, I follow that? Then you get DMs.
Oh yeah, of course.
Why do you follow this person? Who?
Right. All the time. Every week. Every Who? Week.
I've never every heard week. Of that person before in my life. You follow them. Okay. Back off. The algorithm hasn't shown me their tweets in probably 3 years. I completely forgot they existed and I did not know their name. So
yeah,
I don't know what to tell you. So I'll unfollow them because clearly that's a shitty person or a shitty sentiment that I don't agree with.
Sure, totally. And we all need to make those choices. Absolutely. But we also need to, I think, give people the benefit of the doubt.
God,
like, my impulse would be like, hey, Firelight, like,
hey,
you and I are bros. Like,
hey, what's up?
Yeah. Hey. Like, I just noticed this thing and I wanted to ask you about it. And like, that's a conversation that I will have and have had with people.
Yeah.
But what I'm not going to respond to.
What's your conversation, Thorn?
Right. Gross. My default, I hope, isn't going to be like, you follow this person, you're trash, and if you don't make a public statement about X thing, like, it's because you are also trash.
Yeah. No,
you get enough of those and you just stop reading your DMs.
What is the, you know, when you're about to come down again, it's what's the scale of harm here? And what is that person doing with their platform more often than not? Is that person's platform all about them and self-promotion? Is that person's platform just them just talking shit about, I don't know, what they ate for lunch that day? I mean, like, you know, what's this person usually doing with their platform? And is it feasible or reasonable to think that they're, you know, going to know what is going on? And if so, is it reason, you know, are they intentionally not saying something? Like, there's just a lot of calculus you're doing there, an assumption that you're doing there. And yeah, it's, we want to think that a lot of things are, we said at the very beginning, so much of this is calculated, and so, and yet also so much of our online presences are just, I was pooping and I thought of something funny and I said it while I was pooping. So could she, I did not think about it any more than that. It's a funny poop thought, which should be the title of this. Funny poop thoughts with Thorn and Fire.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just, we're all kind of terrible. And that's not to say there isn't a scale of terrible. Like, there are absolutely people in our community who we should be excluding. And there are,
me,
right, like,
I'm a terrible person.
but like, yes, there are, you know, I'm certainly not discouraging that. But I think we also have to give people their autonomy and trust that they're making choices and they know things. And I feel like all of this is connected to, like, author life. I'm thinking about all of these things because everything is so public now. Nobody cared what I thought 10 years ago or 5 years ago.
Well, what's weird is that, I mean, I've been doing a podcast for 12 years, but, like, nobody's actually ever cared what I thought about anything until, like, 24 months ago. Like, that's it. I have had more engagement.
Much.
Like, my social media existence, such as it is, like, exploded several thousand percent in the last 24 months. Like, it's just, yeah, no, it's, yeah.
Yep.
Was there anything that you put into the book because you, like, felt compelled to do it?
Absolutely. The recommended reading list. I was flat out told that I needed a recommended reading list after I'd spent so much time being like, hey, what if we didn't, like, give all of our authority to books.
Uh-huh.
And I needed a recommended reading list. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to put, like, bell hooks on it and not anything that anybody is going to have expected. So that's what I did.
That's it? That's the only part?
Oh no, there's other things. That was the biggest thing. I'm kind of flipping through the book now.
Let's see, what did I end up calling the chapter? Chapter 12, Making Magic. So I originally wrote a chapter where it was just a cleansing chapter. And I did a deep dive into, like, the psychology of cleansing and the science behind cleansing, and yada, yada, yada. Big old cleansing chapter. And then my editor was like, okay, but what if you also did divination and the basics of putting together spells? And I was like, what if I didn't, though? Because I'm not a professional divinatory person. And also, I do kind of talk a lot about, like, being wary of professional divination practices and techniques and stuff earlier in the book. So it almost feels disingenuous for me to talk about that. Nevertheless, that is in the book. Very basics of divination, the very basics of spellcraft. Because even though I say in other parts of the book, I'm like, other books do this better. Go read those. I'm not the authority here.
One of the things that I was asked to put in, and I think people have this idea about Llewellyn in particular, that, like, oh, like, Llewellyn just, you know, like, they only cater to beginners and they just write whatever and they manipulate their authors and blah, 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 blah. And they've got all this control. And that wasn't true. Like, Llewellyn has always been great to me as far as, like, letting me do what I want. But there are a couple of things, kind of, I imagine, the sort of experience you had where they're a capitalistic entity, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Like, their job is to make money. Their job is not to be, like, the source of your spiritual development necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, we have weird ideas about how.
So your title is going to be decided by an algorithm.
Absolutely.
The cover is going to be chosen by trending images. It's
So one of the things that I was told to add, I've got a chapter called Community, which is kind of about, like, it's about drama and starting groups and being in groups. And it's just generally about, you know, a big focus of your book, of course, is, like, how does this stuff actually play out with other people if I'm part of a movement? And I wrote that chapter and Llewellyn came back and was like, we want you to write a section about red flags and warning signs. So I had to write again, you shouldn't have sex with anybody you don't want to. And I feel like if I have to tell you that, like, you've got bigger problems. And that wasn't really what I was thinking about with this book. But nonetheless, there is a section. I don't know.
Why
if
are
it's
you ripping off my book, Thorn?
Right. It's because it's the law. You have to write something about, like, what to watch out. You have to write about predators.
Well, and I'm glad because I put it in my book mostly because I don't see it enough. Does it need to be in every book?
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Like, okay, I'm writing a book about herb, you know, I'm doing the Green Witch thing. Do I need a book? Do I need a chapter about predators? Maybe not. Maybe that book needs a chapter about the potential
not putting
to poison
it in your
yourself
mouth
with plants or something.
And it's not that I thought that they were out of line, and I didn't make a fuss. I wrote it.
Right.
There it is.
Sure.
But, like, one of the reasons I didn't put it in there is because I've written about it 3 million times. It's in my first book. I've got a number of blogs and articles about this stuff exactly.
Did you plagiarize yourself? Did you just copy paste from my blog?
How many times and how many different ways can you say you don't have to have sex with anybody to be an issue? Like, how many times do I have to say that?
I'm not even going to kid. A lot of these blogs are archived right now, but my UPG chapter, some of those early sections mm-hmm. in that UPG chapter, I have written those before.
And you're right. Like, people do need to hear it over and over again. I guess I just sort of.
I mean, I updated it and cleaned it up and made it sound prettier, but.
I guess I just get irritated having to say it over and over again while also listening to people say, oh, all books are the same, or where are the advanced books?
Yeah.
Well, it's because we need to keep saying the same thing over and over again because y'all people aren't doing it. Oh, here's my question for you, kind of segueing from that.
Yes.
I read a lot of books. I obviously have a lot of books. Every time we've been speaking, for those of you who are watching instead of listening, when I'm kind of gazing off, it's because I'm looking at books and that sort of triggers ideas and things in my mind. We know that books and podcasts and everything else are really just like pictures of moments. It's kind of like an encapsulated moment. And we can think about, like, oh, what would I have wanted when I first started, or what do people need right now? But, like, we can only ever write from where we are to the climate we're in, etc.
Mm-hmm.
What is the thing in your book that is going to make you seem dated and out of touch in 10 years?
You know,
or however long. What is the thing?
I kind of speak about this directly at the end, like in my acknowledgments.
Yeah.
I'm like, this book is going, I outright in black and white say, this book is going to become outdated. There's going to be new information that comes along that disproves some of the information used to support arguments in this book.
What is it?
I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be first. Like, all of it? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, someone could finally figure out a quantum computer and then figure out the God part, you know, and figure
out. Can we ever know?
Thoughts really are things or something. Like.
Can we ever know, like, can we anticipate what's going to be dated, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, oh gosh. I mean, I feel like some of it is going to be unfortunately perennial. Because, like, I do a whole chapter on, like, spotting frauds, and unfortunately some of that information is, like, from, like, the 1920s. I mean, it's just, you know, some of these topics are forever, but... I mean, the definition of what a witch is, the definition of a pagan, the definition of, those are probably already outdated. I probably used the wrong definitions. I could see some of the stuff around UPG becoming outdated I could see as more people start writing about it, because some of the feedback that I've gotten is, oh, I haven't seen this in a book, but as people start writing about it and as people start taking that kind of topic more seriously in book form, I could see that very quickly becoming dated because suddenly there's all these perspectives that I hadn't considered before. The nature's magic stuff. I mean, a lot of that's science-based, so science, you know, better science could easily break down some of the science. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Which part of my book do you think is going to get me canceled first?
Oh, I don't know. Well, that's kind of what I was sitting here with, like, your book and my book, which are both here in my hands now.
Well,
and
yours is right here. So.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
I just got this yesterday.
It's so pretty. It's so much more blue than I thought it was going to be.
It is. That was my first reaction, too. It's really blue. Like,
it's really
yours
blue.
For context. Yours is much lighter.
Do you know what color they originally wanted my book cover?
No. Yellow.
Salmon.
Ew. Ew, no. Uh-uh.
Yeah, salmon. And then I tried to flex my contractual right to book cover approval, and I said I wanted it sunflower yellow. And I wanted the wood of the chest to be brown, and I wanted the drawers to be like green or something like that. It was going to be this very bright end of summer tone.
No, I'm into
And I guess somehow we compromised and got like cornflower blue.
Well, and blue is my favorite color, so I think all things should be blue. I
was thinking marketing wise, I was like, if I go to a bookstore and I'm looking at all the books, I feel like sunflower yellow stands out. On
that
the
would
shelf.
Stand out.
It stands out.
The only thing I can think about in terms of your book explicitly is something I already brought up. Your tone generally in this book is one of kind of like disabusement. Like, here, community, I see this a whole lot. Let me tell you the real thing. Like, first, let me tell you what the problems are here. Let's look at it critically and hear some alternative perspectives. So that right there is a statement about what the community seems to think as a whole.
Sure.
Which I hope will change in 10 years.
Obviously.
So I'm hoping that somebody will sit down and go, well, of course I shouldn't put the rock in my anus. Like, why does he even feel the need to tell me that?
Why? Why is he?
Is it because he's fixated on rocks and holes? Like, what is happening here? I could foresee that. I'm so sorry, listeners.
I'm very anally geologically fixated.
That was kind of my only thought, was like, when you're writing with the assumption that this is what people think, and my book does the same thing, because I have long conversations about like, what the fuck is religion? What do we mean when something is secular? And like, that's a moment right now. This would have made no sense in 1998.
Well, and so many of the chapters where I do talk about society and culture, and as it relates to the culture of our witchcraft community, I do bring up very immediately topical things. You know, this book was written during the coronavirus pandemic of 2020. We just went through an election season. You know, I had to change wording of my book because as my book was being written, we changed presidents. And so there was language that was in the book that had to then get changed. There's an immediacy to a statement of here is where our culture is right now as I see it. But then I also spent a lot of time in the book skewering the idea that like, well, this is just one author's perspective. This is just, once again, this is one author's perspective. And in this instance, it's not necessarily on like how to do witchcraft, but what it means to sort of dabble in the culture of witchcraft. What does it mean to explore the spiritual community of witchcraft? But yeah, 100%. I mean, you're incredibly correct there in that as the community changes and evolves, hopefully for the better, or what I think would be better, yeah, then suddenly I look like a crazy person.
Right. Well, and I always have to say this because I feel like this is another one of kind of my pet issues. This is a me problem, everybody, not another people problem. You know, when you read reviews today of books that were written in like the 90s and into like the first decade of the 2000s, one of the things that people will criticize over and over again on social media is like, oh, X author is really misinformed because they think that they're using Wicca and witchcraft interchangeably. They think it's the same thing. And I want to like manifest in their room and be like, no, the climate was so different. The climate was so different in the 90s and into the first decade of the 2000s. It's not that these people don't understand that there are other traditions of witchcraft. It's that you have to think about the satanic panic. Mm-hmm. You have to think about how like there was such a push to make paganism feel like a religion, because we were literally like going to jail and losing children. So like, if you wrote a book that was like, P.S., like Wicca and witchcraft are really different things, witchcraft isn't a religion, like that could very potentially have lost you your job. And that doesn't necessarily happen today. So it's not that those authors were misinformed, because if you go earlier, if you go into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Gerald Gardner didn't call what he was doing Wicca.
No.
Nobody did. Like, Valiente didn't use that. Like, they called what they did witchcraft. Mm-hmm. The term Wicca really developed. Really, it doesn't just develop, but it takes hold and popularity.
Oh, she was trying to say oath-bound stuff.
That was me actually, like, swallowing my own saliva. But, like, that's people, again, thinking about marketing. If it's the 90s and people are afraid of the occult, it would behoove me to not call what I'm doing witchcraft.
You know, and it's funny because I think of like, sure, you read books like in chunks, like when they come out, like, you know, every 3 or 4 years, I feel like we sort of change the tone of witchcraft books and witchcraft, just generally speaking. But yeah, I mean, you read books from like the 90s, even into the early 2000s. And I feel like every single book at that point was witches. They're just like us.
Yes, and it's because we were trying to collective, like Selena Fox is out there trying to get Wicca put on people's dog tags, you know, like
Wiccans, witches, they're just like us. We pay our bills. We're lawyers, we're doctors, and it's always the same. They're the lawyer across the street. They're the businesswoman clattering her heels down Wall Street. It's
the PTA president.
Yes. Yeah, we're all very respectable, and everybody's like, "Yes, we are respectable witches." And
right?
Now
harm
you
none,
get
everybody.
On Twitter and TikTok and stuff, and it's like, "I worship Lord Satan."
I went down to the crossroads last night and had sex with the devil.
Respectability politics. Thank you very much.
Right. And we can, that is privilege. It is privilege to say fuck respectability. That is privilege. So like, you get to be on the internet talking about like your pacts with Satan, and that's great. Hello, I signed up to be a werewolf in the fourth grade by making a pact with Satan out of a Time Life book. I feel you. Yes, absolutely. Witches
work
faithful magic.
Did you do the Temperance Alden lemon werewolf spell?
I'm not a lemon werewolf. I'm a real werewolf. Shade.
Shade.
Although Lemon Supreme is my favorite. Anyway.
The Moist Supreme?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank
it
you.
Is my favorite. That's my birthday cake every year.
Thank you.
But like that was the moment. So like, oh, well, Wiccans, they don't believe in baneful magic and blah, 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 the reed. Well, all of that stuff really comes to the fore during the Satanic Panic. And it's for a reason, everybody. So when you're reading books from the previous generation, the previous decade, and you're going, oh, well, those people are just misinformed. No, they weren't. They were living in a different climate, everybody.
Yes. And that's the part about writing a book that is so scary, is that suddenly it's this, here's what I believe, and I only believe this forever. You know, it's...
Yeah. Well, you know that from having a podcast. Well,
a
you said this.
Last year or so, I was like, you know what? There's just some stuff in those first 100 episodes. That's not helpful. Goodbye. And I archived like 98 episodes. And
I
hit 200 episodes, I'll probably archive the next 100. Like, I just...
See, the ethnographer in me can't do it. Like the person in me with an anthropology background is like, oh no, that is like the record. How dare you disturb the record?
No, I get it. But like at the same time, does the average person on social media care about the record?
No.
Or do they care about finding a reason to get you?
Right. Well, and I'm not, you are correct. I think that is the correct move. But like I can only think of like two instances where I've removed YouTube videos, but you can go through and you can see me with like bad hair in like 2006 or 7 or whatever, and spouting things that felt very reasonable to me at the time, or maybe were reasonable, but they aren't things that I think now. And I will still get comments that are like, you know, well, you're an idiot because blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, y'all, that was 10 years ago, or that was 30.
When this is the thing that made me decide this. So maybe this person's listening, maybe not. But a couple times a year you go and you look at your comments, because I'm an idiot. I think we've all agreed at this point. We all have egos. We don't do this just because we're being altruistic. I would like to hear nice things about myself and the work that I put out. So you go and you look at your comments and somebody was like, so I started listening to his shows and I really loved the podcast and I loved the discourse and I loved the level of discourse. And I just, you know, was really happy with it. So I decided to go back to the beginning. And he read a poem that was really shitty about body image. And that just turned me off. And I was like, well, yeah, I had some really shitty ideas about body image when I was 20. Yes.
Yeah.
I did.
Nope, that makes sense.
I will admit to that. And I have said it many times. But what I say on the show and then put out onto the internet and leave up is then forever. And apparently it's what I think forever. And it is, you know, it's just who you have to be forever and always, and you can never grow.
Yeah.
And if you grow, you're trying to hide the person you were or something.
Right.
Like that.
If you grow, it's because you're trying to hide something.
Yes. Oh, well, this is what he really thinks. It's like, yeah. I wish that people were that. You know, it's funny how we started this conversation saying everything's calculated. And now we're like, nothing is calculated.
Well, it's different now. And I think that's kind of why, like, my output has been a lot lower since I started writing books. I mean, and I go back through my Pathos blog and my YouTube channel and I think, oh my God, I can't believe I published that. Mm-hmm. Like, I cannot believe that I got away with that thing that I said. There are some things that I say in early Pathos blogs, and it's not the ideas I'm presenting. It's the terms I'm using. I'm thinking about specifically, like, ableist language is a great example. Like, removing the word lame from my vocabulary, right? Like, there's stuff like that blogs that I wrote 5 or 6 years ago where I'm just like, oh my God, I would never say that now. Yeah. I can't believe I wrote that. And what's more, I can't believe nobody called me on it. But the reason nobody called me on it is because things shift.
Yeah.
So do I go back and change that stuff? And in some cases I have. In other cases, I kind of want to leave things up. Because I do think it's so important, as I said, to give people the benefit of the doubt, acknowledge growth, look at change. I don't know. Like, I'm not perfect on the internet. I've never been perfect on the internet. And maybe everybody should see everybody's mess sometimes sometimes our standards for each other and for ourselves, it does more harm than good, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. What do you want to write?
I want to write, you like how I have answers like right away.
Is it the Wicca for grownups?
No, I only sort of want to write that when I'm irritated. I don't know if I actually have the energy for that. What I actually want to write, two things. I want to write like balls to the wall, banana pants, UPG, the gods inhabit my body, like ecstatic theology. Because witches don't really do that. We're so obsessed with like, well, other people think that we're so obsessed with like representing everybody else's view and making sure that we're using enough citations that nobody's really writing ecstasy.
I actually meant to, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to hop topics real fast, but I just tell you, I meant to tell you at somewhere around here, after reading your book, I want to go back and redo the way that I did all of my footnotes. Because I love your footnotes.
Chicago Turabian, my friend.
You don't just like cite a source, but you say why that source was chosen and why it's important. And you give like a quick sentence or two about like what somebody should be looking for when they go read that. And I'm like, shit, I am so inadequate in my footnotes.
Nah, that's university lecturer talking.
But I love it.
Yeah, people think they understand. Yeah, people think they understand like citations and why we have bibliographies, but overwhelmingly we don't really understand because nobody teaches us.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Good. I'm glad.
I was reading that and I was like, oh, fuck, that's good.
You can't just cite like Robert Graves or something and expect people to know what you were up to, right? Like, come on. Well, and I think a lot of that was because I did a lot of referencing the Kybalion, and like the Kybalion that's a controversial text for all kinds of reasons, but it's also really significant historically in the development of contemporary witchcraft. And I couldn't just drop the Kabbalion like in a note without being like, hi, everybody. I understand like hermeticism.
Hi, everybody. Thorn here.
Right. But like, I need to reassure you that I understand the delineation, like with hermeticism and the Kabbalion and blah, 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 problems, whatever. But let's talk about New Thought. And I know you don't like it, but it's super influential. Sorry. Like, but like those notes were necessary.
So you want to write ecstatic theology?
Yeah, I want to write like, we're so kind of anti-UPG in so many ways. Oh, this is just that author's UPG. They don't use any citations. Well, no, it's because I practice a tradition that says that I literally can become the mouthpiece of the gods. Like, I sort of want to write that way and see what happens.
This is the skeletal outline for the next book.
Nice.
The voice of God. We're on the same wavelength.
I mean, kinda, yeah. I
also would love the next book I loved writing that UPG chapter, and I don't think that we talk about that enough seriously.
Well, we shame it. We tell people they shouldn't write about that stuff.
Well,
and they shouldn't
talk
about it.
It's funny how we both shame it and also then use it as like a cudgel and as a statement of objective fact and, you know, the way that things are done, and they're done that way because of UPG, and like, it's my UPG, and why is my UPG is important? Because I'm the coven leader. My UPG is the best or whatever. But I would love another book to really slowly dissect what UPG looks like, what sacred space looks like, what is sacred, what, you know, that kind of thing. I would love to get into that space and really expound on it. That would be,
yeah.
I think that would be a fun next step for me.
Well, and I think too, like,
in
here's
the firelight
me,
space. In my real life, I'm writing a romance novel.
Well, yeah, because I also want to write fiction and YA. Like, I'd love
I'm
to write like
a romantic
literary
comedy.
Fiction. Yeah, like I want to write other stuff too, and that's where a lot of my energy has been going these days. But when it comes to like witchcraft stuff,
yeah. What's the next book for Thorn Mooney?
Yeah, I think I'll probably write, you know, and listen to people groan, but whatever. Like, I'll probably write
we'll both be writing books. So we both kind of wrote like a 201 book.
Write a 101 book. I would like something to give. I know, but I don't have one. Sorry, I don't have one. What am I supposed to do?
I was told some very nice, some of the other interviews that I did earlier this summer, I was told by a few people, they were like, because they said the same thing about 101 books. There's not a lot of 101 books that I can give to somebody without a lot of caveats. Mm-hmm. And while I never really intended my book to be a 101 book, I have been told by a few people, they're like, I don't feel like I have a lot of caveats with yours, which that felt like a high praise.
Yeah, it is.
High praise.
People are always like, oh, well, what about X book? And I'm like, I'm not giving X book to my mom. Are you kidding? Yeah. Like, try reading that from an outsider's perspective for 2 seconds. Like, No. Yeah. So I probably will write a Wicca 101 just because I think we need one.
But I also want to read your Wicca 401. You know?
Well,
I want to read.
That's why it's a mystery cult, my friend.
But you know what I mean? Like you said, you can go to a book about Hinduism or Mormonism or Jainism or whatever, and I can read sort of an academic text of what it is. I would like to read that, and I would like you to write it.
Thorn Mooney probably won't write that book. Probably Mary Hamner will.
Oh,
that's me, right? So like probably like the, I don't know, like I think it's helpful to have like that delineation because
it is
Thorn Mooney doesn't have university degrees, but Mary Hamner does. So that's kind of, I think, the objective there.
Oh no, you and I are still playing respectability politics with our dual identities.
You have to. You just do. And I'm not sorry about it. And also, that's also the point of the magical name.
Right?
So like, that's why we have those, everybody.
Yes.
And it's not a secret.
God, I hate mine.
Like, you're stuck with it.
I'm stuck with it.
Yeah. Like it's
when
not
I was
a secret.
Signing a
but...
book contract and they said, what name do you want on the cover? I said, fuck, what name do I want on the cover?
Mm-hmm. I want the one that my boss isn't going to instantly Google.
Yeah, that one.
I guess that's really all it is.
You've built out for 12 years, such as it is.
Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. But I was kind of thinking about the conversation back to UPG, and then I'll stop talking for a sec. But like, you know, for a community that speaks so much about, you know, we're living traditions, connections to the gods, like direct connections to the divine and the spirit world and whatever, and the practice of magic. I think overwhelmingly, we don't believe in magic or the gods. Overwhelmingly, we don't behave as if we do. So that's the quiet part out loud.
I can't hug you, so I'm going to hug this microphone.
Yeah, like I think overwhelmingly, we don't actually believe that the gods are speaking to us. And I think they are. So,
and that's one of the things that I wanted to challenge people on is, okay, what do you mean when you say the gods spoke to you? Did they speak? Was there a voice? Was it as though somebody spoke? And I ask that because I'm not trying to say that these things don't happen. What I'm asking is, it's important to have honest dialogue about the experience itself, because there's a lot of people that are earnestly trying to go about their path and they think they're doing it wrong because corn isn't talking to them.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, you know, like they think they're doing it wrong. And I'm like, you're not, that person's just not quite being honest with you.
I think sometimes it's a kind of dishonesty, but other times I think it's because we speak in metaphor and abstraction.
That's very true. That's very true. And to be the most fair, there are a lot of very good faith. I mean, most people are good faith here talking about this. Most people are acting good faith. And yes, we do talk in metaphor, but that's why I want to say, okay, but let's strip away the metaphor. What happened here? Well, the gods came down in a cloud of thunder and spoke. Okay, so I just want to be very clear here. You are saying that an actual cloud appeared and an actual voice spoke and actually said these things.
Right, and I don't necessarily believe that.
That's the part.
Yes. So for me, when I say, just to clarify, like with folks listening, for me, it's because the sort of witchcraft that I practice, I think transpossession is a thing.
Sure.
So this idea of like,
and there's a lot of documentation for that too.
Yes. This idea of spirits inhabiting bodies. I mean, like that's not just witchcraft. There are lots of traditions that, I mean, like Christianity believes in that, everybody, this idea of the Holy Spirit. If you've ever seen Glossolalia, like functionally, that's what I'm talking about.
If you've ever been in a Southern church during revival, somebody's going to speak in tongues, baby.
Go to a tent revival. They're real common down here. That's what I'm talking about. So when I say that, like the gods speak to us, sometimes I mean that through like somebody else's body. Sometimes I mean that through symbols that I myself have cultivated over the course of years as being meaningful. And I think you're right. A lot of the times people aren't necessarily, they're either dishonest because I think there's insecurity there. We want to make sure that we seem magical to other people.
That was
absolutely
something that I wanted to say in my book out loud. People lie. And
I said it out loud. I'm pretty sure.
Some people, there's a lot of people acting in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
But people lie. And the thing is, there are Absolutely. Liars that act in good faith. They lie in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
But they still know they're lying.
Yes.
There's the nut to crack.
Absolutely.
There's an interesting one.
That's the thing that we have to say, like in books.
Yes.
You know, so yeah,
and
I definitely
we don't do it enough
that.
Because I think that we think, and this is something that I keep coming back to in conversation and in writing and on social media, is that I think for some reason we've got this idea that if we do any real criticism of the community, of the ways in which people act, that for some reason I think that we think that this is all a house of cards, and if you start poking at it, the entire thing might come apart. And I'm like, if your faith, if your witchcraft is that fragile, what did you say?
I would frankly question its effectiveness.
Yes.
Something like, yeah.
Well, you said if your witchcraft isn't setting you, but there was something else that you said that I must not have written down. But you said something along the lines of just like, if it cannot stand up to criticism, I don't know that it's worth believing in.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I think if something doesn't stand up to scrutiny, then that's a problem. And if you're afraid to scrutinize it, that's also a problem.
And don't you want to, like, if it's a bad idea, don't you want to make room for better ideas?
Mm-hmm.
I just, why hold on to a bad idea? Ew.
Well, the cool thing about scrutiny is if you scrutinize something and it holds up, then your conviction grows.
Exactly.
It's exactly. Like skepticism is good, everybody.
It is. You know, we say that we're like, oh, I'm for the scientific method. I'm yada, yada, yada. I'm like, okay, great. What's your research? What does your research method look like?
Yeah.
The looks you get.
That's a lot. I feel like we said a lot of things. I hope people found this insightful. And I
would like
did.
All of you to go out right now and order a copy of The Witch's Path, Advancing Your Craft at Every Level by Thorne Mooney. It is very good.
I'm not anti-vax.
Called out many times. And especially in the chapter that was called Firelight is an Asshole and Other Truths, that chapter I did feel particularly called out on. Mm-hmm. My delicate fifis were hurt. My delicate fifis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and likewise, I think the Dabbler's Guide. Oh, I wanted to talk to you too about the use of the word dabbler in connection with audience, because we're talking to particular people, and I think I'm giving you your outro here.
Okay.
I think we have particular expectations for what a seeker's book looks like, what a beginner's book looks like, what a book should look like if we're trying to clear up misinformation. And I sort of love that you embrace the word dabbler and you talk about like what that means for you and what that looks like. And then so much of your focus is on like not some kind of hypothetical life that you could live if you started practicing witchcraft, but it's about kind of looking at how things are right now. What do our communities look like right now? And where are the ugly parts? While still maintaining that sense of fun and mystery and magic. And I feel like so many times we ask readers to choose either or. They can either have fun or be critical, do work or be silly. And you don't do that. Both of those things are allowed. All of those things are allowed. So The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, Seeking an Intentional Magical Path, everybody.
It is an SEO-friendly title. Thank you.
Yeah, it is. You got a lot of words here that cover that.
It's got a lot of buzzwords.
It's good though.
It was like the 47th title. So
yeah, mine had a whole lot of titles too.
Yeah.
So
yep.
It was Thorne originally
Mooney's
called
Book Two. How about that?
Book
how about
two.
That's book two.
That's how I refer to it. It was originally called Next Level Witchcraft, which has there's all kinds of problems there. But I was like, all right, that sort of works. Whatever.
Mine was also a my original title was Ethical Dabbling, which was there's all kinds of problems there, but
yep.
I did still make that a chapter title though. I was like, I'm gonna get that in there somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get it in there somewhere.
So praise Satan, dear listeners.
September 2021 is the best month for witchcraft books.
It is.
Congratulations, you wrote a great one.
You too. It's good talking to you. Thank you for talking to me always about real things, too.
Oh my gosh, of course.
People are boring.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today. Thank you for joining me for this unique episode in which I was both interviewer and interviewee. I hope that you enjoyed it. Please, 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 I cannot recommend enough Thorne's new book, The Witch's Path. I do think that no matter how far along you are, there is something here for you. But for folks that have been on this path a while, this is really going to be a comfort read to you. So go out and get it. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't plug my own book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, comes out next week. It will be available everywhere books are sold. You can pre-order it now. The link to do so is bit.ly/dabblersguide. I hope that you enjoy it. It was a labor of love, and it's been many, many, many years in the making. But, you know, it's an exciting and terrifying time all at the same time. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help do that. Not just by buying my book. you can consider liking and sharing the show on social media. That's a free way to help tell other people like you, your friends and loved ones, that you like this show and you think they'd get something out of it. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. Seriously, the reviews really help. You might have heard a lot of creators on a lot of other podcasts these days kind of talking about the importance of leaving those reviews. I know in recent years, people kind of stopped doing that, and mostly just, you know, because a lot of platforms don't do it. But seriously, any comment, a word, an emoji, they like, it's like a super boost in the algorithm. So if you like the show, consider leaving a comment, 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. The algorithm will thank you. Help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can monetarily. You can buy me a coffee, which is a one-time donation of your choosing, or if you'd like to give a little bit more or a little bit more often, you can join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. This month, the Patreon roundtable is always the very last Friday of the month at 7 p.m. Central Time. And this month, all Patreon members, so if you're listening to this, that could be you too if you sign up for Patreon, all Patreon members are invited to a roundtable with me and several undisclosed special guests to chat about the Dabbler's Guide. And a lot of you got free early copies with your Patreon subscription. Roundtable members also are getting a free signed copy of the book. The cutoff for that was earlier this month, so sorry if you missed that deadline. So this month, if you would like to come to my digital launch party and party with me and some friends and special guests and stuff, sign up for my Patreon at patreon.com/incitingariot. And all tiers are welcome to the roundtable this month. It's my my little digital release party. Anyways, once again, one last plug. The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft comes out September 28th, everywhere books are sold. That's not just the book. That's the paperback, the ebook, and the audiobook, all at the same time, all on September 28th. You can find me online. The website is incitingariot.com. You can email me about this show or any other at Firelight. That's FIRELYTE at incitingariot.com. And I'm at Inciting a Riot on most forms of social media. One last really important plug. It is the last few days of the submission deadline to submit your short stories, your spooky tales, your poems, your spells, your whatever, for inclusion in the Samhain special. Remember, this year there is a contest. First prize wins $50 plus a copy of my book. Second prize wins $25 plus a copy of my book. And third prize wins a copy of my book. Everyone else will get an opportunity to be included in the show. But I will tell you, but by the emptiness of my inbox, you have a really good chance to win. Really good chance. So if you would like to submit a short story or something to be included in the Samhain special, please email Firelight. That's FIRELYTE at incitingariot.com. And, you know, just put in the subject line that this is for Samhain special 2021 to be included. Anyways, that's going to be everything. The deadline for that is the very last day of September at midnight. And I'm going to be making all of my edits and inclusions and announcements and stuff the first week of October. Anyways, that's going to do it for me here today on Inciting a Riot. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks so much for all of your support. And thanks for joining me in the next chapter of my public pagan life. Thanks. And I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light. Firelight.